Chapter 77. For there is no French army. France's fame is fouled. And how, then, could we fight today with our hearts in our shoes? Wellington, why, that bears out what I but lately said. It was not like the brave men who have faced, and foiled me here, so many a long year past, to give away a stubborn station quite so readily. Beresford, and what, messieurs, ensued at Leipzig then? Several French officers, why, sirs, should we conceal it? Thereupon part of our army took the Lutzen road, behind a blown-up bridge. Those in advance arrived at Lutzen with the Emperor, the scene of our once famous victory. In such sad sort retreat was hurried on, Erfurt was gained with Blücher hot at heel. To cross the Rhine seemed then our only hope. Alas, the Austrians and the Bavarians faced us in Anna Forest, led by Reed, and dead blocked our escape. Wellington, ah! Did they though? Second French officer, but if brave hearts were ever desperate, sir, we were desperate then. We pierced them through, our loss unrecking. So by Frankfurt's walls we fared to Mainz, and there we crossed the Rhine. A funeral procession, so we seemed, upon the long bridge that had run so oft to our victorious feet. What since has coursed we know not, gentlemen. But this we know, that Germany echoes no French footfall. An English officer, one sees not why it should. Second French officer, we'll leave it so. Conversation on the Leipzig disaster continues till the dinner ends. The French prisoners courteously take their leave and go out. Wellington, very good set of fellows. I could wish they all were mine. Well, there was no crime in trying to ascertain these fat events. They would have sounded soon from other tongues. Hill, it looks like the first scene of act the last for our and all men's foe. Wellington, I count to meet the Allies upon the cobblestones of Paris before another half year's suns have shone. But there's some work for us to do here yet. The dawn must find us fording the Nivelle. Exeunt Wellington and officers. The room darkens. Act 4th, scene I, the Upper Rhine. The view is from a vague altitude over the beautiful country traversed by the Upper Rhine, which stretches through it in bird's eye perspective. At this date in Europe's history, the stream forms the frontier between France and Germany. It is the morning of New Year's Day, and the shine of the tardy sun reaches the fronts of the beetling castles, but scarcely descends far enough to touch the wavelets of the river winding leftwards across the many-leagued picture from Schaffhausen to Koblenz. Dumb show, at first nothing, not even the river itself seems to move in the panorama. But anon certain strange dark patches in the landscape, flexuous and ribbon-shaped, are discerned to be moving slowly. Only one movable object on earth is large enough to be conspicuous herefrom, and that is an army. The moving shapes are armies. The nearest, almost beneath us, is defiling across the river by a bridge of boats, near the junction of the Rhine and the Neckar, where the oval town of Mannheim, standing in the fork between the two rivers, has from here the look of a human head in a cleft stick. Martial music from many bands strikes up as the crossing is effected, and the undulating columns twinkle, as if they were scaly serpents. Spirit of rumor, it is the Russian host, invading France. Many miles to the left, downstream, near the little town of Cobb, another army is seen to be simultaneously crossing the pale current, its arms and accoutrements twinkling in like manner. Spirit of rumor, thither the Prussian levies to advance. Turning now to the right, far away by Basel, beyond which the Swiss mountains close the scene, a still larger train of war-geared humanity, 200,000 strong, is discernible. It has already crossed the water, which is much narrower here, and has advanced several miles westward, where its ductile mass of grayness and glitter is beheld parting into six columns that march on in flexuous courses of varying direction. Spirit of rumor, there glides carked Austria's invading force. Panting to, Paris wards with foot and horse, of one intention with the other twain, and Wellington, from the south, in Upper Spain. All these dark and gray columns, converging westward by sure degrees, advance without opposition. They glide on, as if by gravitation, in fluid figures, dictated by the conformation of the country, like water from a burst reservoir, mostly snake-shaped, but occasionally with Batrachian and Saurian outlines. In spite of the immensity of this human mechanism on its surface, the winter landscape wears an impassive look, as if nothing were happening. Evening closes in, and the dumb show is obscured. Scene 2, Paris. The Tuileries, it is Sunday just after Mass, and the principal officers of the National Guard are assembled in the Salle des Mariachaux. They stand in an attitude of suspense, some with the print of sadness on their faces, some with that of perplexity. The door leading from the hall to the adjoining chapel is thrown open. There enter from the chapel with the last notes of the service the Emperor Napoleon and the Empress, and simultaneously from a door opposite Madame de Montesquieu, the governess, who carries in her arms the King of Rome, now a fair child between 2 and 3. He is clothed in a miniature uniform of the guards themselves. Madame de Montesquieu brings forward the child, and sets him on his feet near his mother. Napoleon, with a mournful smile, giving one hand to the boy, and the other to Marie-Louise, en famille, leads them forward. The guard bursts into cheers. Napoleon, gentlemen of the National Guard and friends, I have to leave you, and before I fare to heaven know what of personal destiny, I give into your loyal guardianship those dearest in the world to me, my wife, the Empress, and my son the King of Rome. I go to shield your roofs and kin from foes who have dared to pierce the fences of our land, and knowing that you house those dears of mine, I start afar in all tranquility, stayed by my trust in your proved faithfulness. Enthusiastic cheers for the guard. Officers, with emotion, we proudly swear to justify the trust. And never will we see another sit than you, or yours, on the great throne of France. Napoleon, I ratify the Empress's regency, and reconfirm it on last year's lines, my brother Joseph stoutening her rule as the Lieutenant General of the State. Vex her with no divisions. Let regard for property, for order, and for France be chief withal. No, gentlemen, the Allies are drunken with success. Their late advantage they have handled wholly for their own gross gain, and made a pastime of my agony. That I go clogged with cares I sadly own, yet I go primed with hope. A, in despite of a last sorrow that has sunk upon me, the grief of hearing, good and constant friends, that my own sister's consort, Naples' king, blazons himself a backer of the Allies, and marches with a Neapolitan force against our puissance under Prince Eugene. The varied operations to ensue may bring the enemy largely Paris-wards, but suffer no alarm. Before long days I will annihilate by flank, and rear those who have risen to trample on our soil, and as I have done, so many and proud a time, come back to you with ringing victory. Now, see, I personally present to you my son, and my successor ere I go. He takes the child in his arms, and carries him round to the officers severally. They are much affected, and raise loud cheers. You stand by him and her? You swear as much? Officers, we do. Napoleon, this you repeat, you promise it? Officers, we promise. May the dynasty live forever. Their shouts, which spread to the carousal without, are echoed by the soldiers of the guard assembled there. The Empress is now in tears, and the Emperor supports her. Marie-Louise, such whole enthusiasm I have never known. Not even from the landwehr of Vienna. Amid repeated protestations and farewells, Napoleon, the Empress, the King of Rome, Madame de Montesquieu, etc. go out in one direction, and the officers of the National Guard in another. The curtain falls for an interval. When it rises again, the apartment is in darkness, and its atmosphere chilly. The January night wind howls without. Two servants enter hastily, and light candles and a fire. The hands of the clock are pointing to 3. The room is hardly in order when the Emperor enters, equipped for the intended journey, and with him, his left arm being round her waist, walks Marie-Louise in a dressing gown. On his right arm he carries the King of Rome, and in his hand a bundle of papers. Count Bertrand and a few members of the household follow. Reaching the middle of the room, he kisses the child and embraces. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.